when it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
Luke's English podcast is made possible thanks to the premium subscription, in which I help you focus specifically on learning vocabulary, grammar, and pronunciation. The idea is that as well as listening to episodes of this podcast to get plenty of exposure to authentic English as it is spoken, you can also get the benefit of my teaching skills as I break things down for you into bite-sized chunks, helping you learn more vocabulary, understand grammar properly, and develop clear and natural pronunciation. Recently, I've uploaded two premium episodes. There's P30, which is all about how you can speak more persuasively, more engagingly, and clearly by breaking your speech into chunks. And there's video, audio, and PDF versions of that. And then P31, which is called What Did Jill Say? And it focuses on useful language used by my mum and me in our recent conversation about the Beatles in episode 717. And that includes grammar for speculating about the past with modal verbs and loads of nice vocabulary expressions too. To access all those episodes, you need a premium account. And to sign up for that, or to get all of the information that you need, including exactly how reasonable the prices are, you could just go to teacherluke.co.uk/premium info. Luke's English Podcast Premium. teacherluke.co.uk/premium info. You're listening to Luke's English Podcast. For more information, visit teacherluke.co.uk. So, hello, listeners. How are you today? You are now listening to episode number 732. And in this one, I'm talking again to Christian Saunders from Kangaroo English. This is the second time I'm talking to him on the podcast. I previously interviewed Christian in episode 686 last year and got to know him a bit. But I wanted to talk to him again after having seen some of his most recent videos on YouTube about language and language learning. In his videos, Christian often challenges certain assumptions and myths about language learning. And so I thought it might be interesting to talk to him about those things. So I came up with some questions about language, learning language, and teaching English on the internet. There is a video version of this conversation on my YouTube channel too. So don't forget to check it out. And of course, don't forget to like and subscribe while you're there. Don't forget to smash that like button, okay, guys? There's no more for me to add here in the introduction. I hope you enjoy this conversation and get some good things from it. Once again, Christian's YouTube channel is called Kangaroo English and his website is kangarooenglish.com. Okay, right, so let's get started and here we go.
Hello, we're talking about language.
Sit down, let's have a chat.
A bit of a chat, sir.
A bit of a chat, yes, Roger, just a bit of a chat.
What about, sir?
About English as a global language.
This is a conversation.
Yes.
I would like to talk to you.
Okay, let's talk. Let's have a quick conversation, huh? What do you think?
That's what we're going to do.
Away, baby. Let's go.
We're going to have a good time. We're going to have a conversation.
About language.
Christian, hello. Good morning.
Morning. Good morning, Luke. I'm so honored that you would invite me back. I have to say that of all of the kind of YouTube channels and podcasts that I've ever been, you know, invited on, yours I think is the only one where I've just had so many people come to me and say, I know you because of Luke, or I heard you on Luke's podcast. So clearly you're a very popular man, which is to your credit, sir, to your credit.
I'm deeply influential. Everything I say has huge consequences and ramifications around the world. So it's very nice to be able to spread my influence on planet Earth.
When people ask you what you do, how do you describe yourself?
sometimes it's a bit too complicated to say that I'm a podcaster. Plus, also, if I say, oh, I'm a podcaster, it sort of makes me feel a bit like a twat. So I probably don't say that. I tend to say that I'm an English teacher and I also have a podcast. And then, oh, actually, that's the main thing I do these days. What about you? What do you say?
Yeah, it is complicated because saying that you're a YouTuber, unfortunately, puts you into a basket or puts you into a category with a lot of unsavory characters. And because I'm thinking about how what you said about having influence, right? And, you know, I think now, like being a YouTuber, being an influencer, a lot of these things have a lot of negativity associated with them, right? And so it's kind of sometimes embarrassing even to say that you're, you know, that you're part of that.
that you're an Instagram influencer, because then people just imagine that you're posing with your bum out on a beach somewhere.
And they're looking at me and going, how the hell is this? What is he doing with
beard related products? What's he selling?
Although I have to tell you just a quick little story. Because we went on holiday recently to Gran Canaria, because it's part of Spain, so we don't actually leave. Technically, you're not leaving the country, so you don't have to worry about, you know, travel restrictions. So when we went there was, I don't know if it's the time of year or if it's just because, you know, certain places get associated with tourists from certain countries, right?
Yes.
And it seems that in Gran Canaria, there's a lot of German tourists. And me and my wife discovered that German men are not afraid of wearing very, very small swimwear. And we saw a guy on the beach. He was probably 50 years old, between 50 and 60. Enormous beer gut, right?
Yeah.
And he was wearing a pink thong on the beach.
Oh, my God. A thong.
A thong.
Not so just
his butt was out, right?
Yeah. What's the thinking behind the thong for anyone, but especially for men? What's the justification? So just in case people don't know, a thong is not just a pair of Speedos, but it's where at the back you've got kind of like string, and then one piece of string that goes into the bum crack. And it's essentially like the closest you can get to just not wearing any pants at all. But what's the justification for wearing one of those?
The justification is that you are tanning every available, you know, square inch of your skin. You have a perfectly even tan, no lines, you know, no marks. And I mean, the guy was a perfectly even color all over, which is incredible to me, because if I go to the beach and try to tan, I tan in kind of stripes and patches, and
yeah, it's like me.
I don't know how people, like how people do it. Yeah. Oh, wow.
For video viewers, you can see right now that, I mean, maybe it's not that clear, but I've got the classic English tan where there is a line where the arm of my t-shirt stops. There is a clear line, and it's the same on the back of my neck where I'm, you know, I'm tanned, and then wherever my t-shirt's been is just like awful pale flesh. So yeah, I guess that's what this guy was doing. He was just trying to get the all over body tan, but it's a bit weird, isn't it? That like he's so conscious of his appearance, but he's got this huge beer belly. So, you know, get the priorities right, mate.
Exactly. But I mean, I couldn't tell him any of this because I don't speak German. So.
Right. And would you anyway? Excuse me. You're German, right? Okay. Let's conduct this conversation in German. You've got your bum out, but you're not working on your beer belly. What's going on? I don't know. That would be strange indeed.
I'm gonna guess that maybe beer belly in German is like Biergutten, maybe something like that, right?
Biergut. Could be. It's going to be one word, isn't it? It's going to be one long word. Noun of some kind. Okay, so I don't know how we ended up talking about thongs and beer bellies, but we did.
I'm really sorry, we've kind of immediately brought the whole tone of the discussion down.
Well, for me it was down there already anyway. That's kind of where I live, is, you know, in that at that level. But this is where I can segue into talking about your content. I should also say that this is the people listening to this on the podcast. This is also available on YouTube, so you can see video versions of this. And if you do watch the video, you'll see two bearded men. It's like Battle of the Beards today.
There is one area of inequality, Luke.
Yes, I'm sorry. My hair is sprouting. It's in fact too long. I'm having a haircut tomorrow. But I think you win in the beard department. I think you've got the stronger, healthier beard going on.
Yeah, but look, it's already grey. You know, I mean, come on.
That's good though.
Does it make me look like George Clooney? Because I think he's got, you know, some salt and pepper in his beard. No,
it's very distinguished. Having some grey in the beard, it gives you a very distinguished look. I think it's good.
Thank you.
Right, so Christian, I wanted to talk to you again because for a while I've wanted to have a deeper discussion about some of the videos which you've put up on YouTube and some of the ideas and opinions you presented in those videos. And you put up quite a lot of content on YouTube, and most of your videos are monologues, and they're a bit like video essays in which you present an argument about some aspect of English learning. Also, you're often a bit controversial, and I think that you like to challenge accepted views on language learning, smash myths which are perpetuated among the community and industry of language learning. You often use metaphors, and you usually speak in this deliberate and persuasive manner. And sometimes I feel like you are a bit like Morpheus from The Matrix, you know, almost like feel like you would say, you know, what if I told you that blah, blah, blah. Like, you know, a lot of your videos are things like, you know, what if I told you that learning a language was like eating a pineapple? You know, I feel like...
Or blue pill, red pill, right?
Yeah. Blue pill, red pill. Which pill, actually, Christian, in terms of language learning? The blue pill or the red pill? It's an easy question, I suppose.
It's like if you take this pill, you will continue your normal life believing that you can get fluent in 3 months. And that you need to have a British accent to communicate. If you take this pill, then you'll see the truth, which is that you have to suffer for the rest of your life. But at least you'll be awake. Which one do you want?
Yes, it is like The Matrix. Yeah, the hard truth and just kind of like, yeah, being given the myth and stuff. But these are some of the things I wanted to talk to you about, right? So I just wanted to have a conversation with you about some of the points you've made in your videos. And here's a kind of an overview of some of the ideas. So recently you did one about comprehensible, that's not how you say that, comprehensible input and Stephen Krashen. You've talked about course books and language classrooms, just the whole idea of right and wrong in English, grammar, exams, setting goals and objectives, pronunciation, speaking like a native, and then general advice for learning English. These are just some of the things that we could cover. We probably won't deal with all of them. But before we do that, I would just like to ask you this: sort of, where do your ideas come from? What are your ideas based on? Where do your opinions about language learning actually come from?
I mean, my video ideas are basically whatever I'm kind of obsessed with at the time. I'm not going to try and pretend that there's any order or logic about the. There's no structure. It's just, you know, I'm kind of obsessed about, you know, comprehensible input. So I'm just going to make a video about it. That's actually something that I wanted to try and take more control of that. You know, I wanted to really like this year, I wanted to introduce more structure, right, and have some sort of plan. But it hasn't happened so far. I'm still waiting for that to happen.
Total chaos, I mean, basically, is what you're suggesting. That you're just
total
you're,
chaos.
It's just complete chaos behind the scenes. Now, the videos are very well presented. It all looks very, very beautiful and very well organized. The way you speak in them is very controlled. But actually, behind the scenes, behind the curtain, it's just complete madness. Like, oh God, what am I going to do next? I know how you feel. It's like that for me too.
It is. I mean, I think I went through a phase where I was totally obsessed with just the research, you know. And I thought that if you do exactly what they say in the research, like if a paper comes out and it says the best thing that, you know, we've studied 50 people and the best thing you can do is this, and I'd be like, right, okay, everybody, we should do this. But I had a few conversations with some people, you know, that have a lot of experience in the field, you know, like 50 years of working in not just research but also in the classroom, you know. And I think I slowly began to realize that, number one, and this is something which is kind of new to me, you know, in like in the past, let's say in the past 12 months, number one is that, you know, research can only be trusted to a point, you know, and that, you know, a bigger problem in science right now in all fields, you know, in biology and physics and is replication, right? So you can do a study 1 week in one place and then you repeat it somewhere else and you find something completely different, you know? So I think I have learned to become suspicious, right? Not suspicious, skeptical about research. And so now I'm trying to find this balance between, you know, following what does the science tell us about language learning, but also like, what do I know from actually working with students and what, and people who have been teaching for 20 years or 30 years, you know, what do they know because they are actually in the classroom doing it, you know, and those, so it's that balance, right? Where both things are equally valuable and, you know, we have to be skeptical of both, right? So that's sort of where I am right now. Yeah.
Yeah. Critical thinking, but academic research that you've read, experienced professionals who you've spoken to, and then just your own experience, it all sort of combines together to create the positions that you have on things.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I'm sure, Luke, that you know, there are things, I'm sure that there are things that you would do in the classroom that are probably, mm-hmm. let's say, against what the research says, right? But, well, you know.
You don't know what I'm doing in my classroom, Sir Christian. Yes, I would probably say so. I wonder what. But, yeah, there's bound to be things that sort of are traditionally considered to be wrong. I mean, there's always disagreement, you know, things swing this way and that way. Like, yes. You know, the idea of teacher talking time, when I was like going through all my training, that was like a bad thing. And people talked about how terrible that was. But then like a few years later, you know, these articles and papers and stuff talking about how great teacher talking time is. And that actually, if the teacher devotes some time, not too much, but some time to talking to the students, that the students then are more likely to replicate it, you know, that in a task, if you give an example, the students kind of get the idea, and you know that's kind of natural, that if I do 5 minutes of talking, you feel obliged to do 5 minutes of talking in return, and so yeah. Teacher talking time can actually increase student talking time and things like that. Yes.
Exactly. And also, you know, what also goes with that is when the teacher is talking, should you prohibit them from talking, you know, let's say they're native Spanish speakers, should they be prohibited from speaking Spanish if they're teaching English? You know, should they only speak in English if they're teaching English? You know, this is another thing. For many, many years, teachers were told, whatever you do, don't speak in your native language, right? Because you're robbing all your students of the opportunity to hear the language. But now, you know, now it's kind of the other way. It's like, it's fine to speak in your native language, right? But
yeah, a bit, yeah.
You know, and this is, again, this is probably something that teachers who have been in the classroom for 30 years, they already know this, right? So that's why, you know, that's why following the research has to be done with skepticism, right?
Plus the fact that the history of sort of understanding language learning, which is fairly recent, really, that you've gone through all these different phases, that one accepted standard gets replaced by another and another and another, and it kind of goes through these trends that seem to contradict each other to an extent. So yeah, it's kind of like we're on shifting sands in terms of language learning and understanding how it works, and the general accepted approaches to it change all the time. So yeah, you've got to be skeptical of the research, and yes, use a lot of practical experience, just what works in the classroom for you.
Yeah. Exactly.
Getting more specific, right? So the other day I saw one of your uploads, and it was about Stephen Krashen and the input hypothesis. And for those people who aren't aware of it, that Stephen Krashen's theory is the idea that people learn languages primarily through understanding written and oral texts, that you learn a language basically when you understand it, and reading and listening are essential parts of the process. And this is a very popular idea. It's often quoted and repeated, especially these days. And you kind of you sort of disagreed with it in the video, and I felt a little bit disappointed, because as a podcaster, obviously the Stephen Krashen's ideas, which are that learners should consume a lot of English, do lots of listening and reading, obviously this idea suits me quite well, because here I am producing content for people to use to learn. So I was a little disappointed, you know, with your diagnosis of it. So what's your beef with the Stephen Krashen and the input hypothesis?
There is one thing that I regret about that video, right? Which is, I didn't make something clear, which I thought would be clear, but then when I look at the video again, I realize that it's not. But basically, Stephen Krashen's his language acquisition kind of theory, or the input hypothesis, has five parts. Yeah, and one of those is that we learn only through input, right? Through comprehensible input. And I included a portion of an interview he did very recently where he says that we only acquire language when we understand it, right? So we don't acquire language from speaking. We don't acquire language from studying or memorizing or any of those things. So, the theory is that it's just everything that comes in, that's all you need to learn a language. And my video was specifically to disagree with that. But what, yes, I didn't make clear was that, of course you need input, right? I wasn't saying that you don't need input. What I was disagreeing against is that you need only input, right? And so I'm upset with myself that I didn't make that clear. And so in the comments underneath the video, a lot of people, kind of said, well, you know, this guy's an idiot, because how are you going to learn a language if you don't have any input? And I'm just like, oh God, no, that's not what I wanted to say. You know, of course you need input, but it cannot be just only input. And of course the other, so there's basically two main threads to the people who don't agree with my video. The first one is that of course you need input, right? And the second one is that basically I don't understand his theory. Okay. So, I mean, this is a very typical kind of argument, not just, you know, on YouTube, but in anywhere. It's like, if you disagree with something, then the reason you disagree with it is because you don't understand it. So you need to read more, or you just need to be smarter. You're obviously an idiot, right? But, you know, people can disagree with things and also fully understand it, right?
What apparently don't you understand about it?
That's not made clear. Well, I mean, some people have said, you know, you don't understand the theory because Mr. Krashen doesn't actually say that you're not allowed to speak. In fact, he says that speaking is good, right? And he doesn't, you know, so he's not prohibiting output. So this video is a straw man argument, right? It's basically you are constructing, you're misrepresenting his views. which I don't think that I am, because sure, he's not prohibiting speaking or writing or any kind of conversation or output, but why would you do it if you don't, if you only need input, right? So he's prohibiting it through reduction. I mean, what I mean is, if you only need input to learn a language, then why would I waste my time having conversations or writing a diary or, you know, doing any of that, right?
Yes. But the theory doesn't prohibit speaking, which is obviously a vital thing to practice. I guess what, by acquisition, I guess he's talking about sort of getting language, because it's so complicated. You know, you've got to get the stuff first, and then you've got to produce it. But it's got to be in there first before it can come out, I suppose, is what he's thinking.
In the world of language learning, like if you're just an ordinary person wanting to learn a language, you probably have never heard of Stephen Krashen, and you can spend 20 years learning a language and you will never hear of him, right? You know, he's like everybody in this field, you know, he's a fringe kind of person. He's a small personality, right? Mm-hmm. You know, so the video has attracted lots of people who either are English teachers or they work as researchers, you know, this kind of people. So the discussion is a different kind of discussion. And there's a lot of people saying, well, how can you be against the input hypothesis when there's so much research to support it? Well, I mean, there isn't, for a start. And in fact, there's lots of research to show that that without output, that you can't really progress, right? I mean, this for example, I don't know if you know the book by Spada and Lightbound called it's called How to Learn a Language.
I don't think I do.
Yeah, so I mean, it's kind of for people who go to university and study language acquisition. It's kind of like one of the Bibles, you know. Mm-hmm. And they just released the fifth edition, I think, a couple of weeks ago, which has been revised, you know. And I'm just going to read a very small part from this. It says that research has overwhelmingly confirmed that vocabulary growth will be limited if the learner does not also engage in focused vocabulary learning activities. And there's also evidence that vocabulary development is more successful when learners are fully engaged in activities that require them to use them in productive tasks, right? So I just think the accusation that all of the weight of evidence is on the side of you know, the input hypothesis is just not true at all, you know. And I mean, I actually asked my wife about this because I thought, well, I could make a video where I just pull out all of the evidence, all of the, you know, academic research against this. Mm-hmm. But I'm kind of then what's the point of like me? What's the point of my, you know, my personality and my own, what's the point of my own identity if I'm just regurgitating other people's stuff? So I kind of decided to do it without talking about any research at all. So,
okay. So, I mean, do your videos get sort of heated responses? Do people disagree with you and stuff?
I'm going to say in general, like 95% of the time, no. It's like, you know, all of the comments are just love, you know.
Yeah, I've seen that.
And I think, you know, and that is absolutely not because, you know, my content is like the best or anything. Because if you look at basically any English teacher on YouTube, you know, go and look at even the tiny channels, massive channels. It's all love in the comments section. Right? All love.
Yeah, it's amazing, isn't it? I have to admit, sometimes I'll have a look at other people's content and people are writing, you're the best English teacher in the world. And I think to myself, wait a minute, I thought I was the best. What?
who is this person? You know, and every single English teacher online is the best English teacher in the world, which is like, okay, great, this is fine.
I mean, how did we end up in an industry where we're appreciated so much? I mean, that's really lucky, right?
I think I have to say a large part of it is because we're giving it all away for free, right? I mean, English is a sort of a buyer's market in a sense. I don't want that to sound like we're not privileged to have English as our first language, because obviously it's a huge privilege. You know, I think about that all the time, that because English is like this language that everyone wants, and it's my first language, and, you know, I just grew up speaking like this. It's just a huge privilege that allows me to just, you know, people just want to listen to me. What was the question? What were we talking about?
Why do we experience so much positivity?
So much love. Maybe sometimes I think it's because we give away content free, and so people feel sort of that they should be very positive. But at the same time, you know, maybe it's just that language learners are generally sort of lovely. There's something inherently humane about learning a language. And when you're learning it from someone who's there to help you, that is sincerely a pleasant thing, and people feel that they genuinely get things from us, and so they feel it's only natural to then say thank you so much, because we are being helpful. Maybe it's justified, maybe it's not just hyperbole from our audience, maybe they really mean it, you know.
I really think so. And you know, this goes back to the thing you said at the very beginning of this conversation, right, about how you want people to consume your content, right? And you know, if there's somebody out there who's saying, you know, you don't need input, right, then it's kind of like, oh. But, you know, I think Krashen would actually be on your side 100%, because – I think your content is actually, you know, you're not on this podcast to, you know, give lessons about how to construct the present simple, you know, or, you know, what's the best way to memorize 10 words. You know, you're actually producing content, right? Like, the language is secondary. It's like people listen to you because they want to actually hear the content of what you're saying. It's not, you know, focus on form, not focus on forms or whatever it is. You know, like,
hopefully the consequence is that sort of they do. I mean, this is basically Stephen Krashen's idea, to like, to put it very simply, that people will just sort of pick up English as a consequence of focusing on the message that's being communicated. And it's a long-term process and stuff, but of course that can't be the only thing. I mean, I always say that my podcast is best consumed as part of a balanced diet. You know, that it's obviously just listening to me is not going to be everything. You need to do lots of speaking. You need to read and write and all those other things too.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, but again, it's the question that the student has to ask themselves, you know, well, what do you want? I spoke a couple of years ago to Steve Kaufman, the hyperpolyglot, the Canadian hyperpolyglot. So he speaks, I don't exactly know how many languages he...
Too many languages, Christian. He needs to stop. Someone needs to stop him. Stop stevekaufman.com.
But yeah, he, you know, and I know that for some of his languages, you know, he's not interested in having conversations in those languages. You know, he wants to just... you know, read. He wants to be able to consume content, and that's fine. Like, that's his, you know, he wants to know the language in the same way that we might, you know, I might be fascinated with rabbits. And so I read a book about the anatomy of rabbits and rabbit behavior, but I'm not gonna, you know, make rabbits my full-time job, you know? So
I'd hope so, because that would be a terrible idea. Like, Christian, what happened to Christian from Kangaroo? Oh, he stopped doing YouTube, and, well, I know he's just got really obsessed with rabbits. It's really weird. Anyway, that's best not talk about it.
This is why I have to write scripts for my videos, because otherwise I come out with the dumbest examples in the world. Oh my god!
What was the point you were making, though? Sorry.
You know what? No, I think the point is that so Steve, when he's learning a language, sometimes his objective is probably what, for example, Stephen Krashen would call acquiring language. You know, he wants to just know it. You know, but you know, for a lot of learners, especially if you're learning English, let's say for a practical reason, you know, like you do want to be able to maybe work in that language, right? Then input isn't going to be enough. Like exactly what you said, you need the balanced diet. You know, the first question is always the student has to ask themselves, what do I want? And, you know, just I think the general rule is to be wary of anybody who tells you that they have the answers, you know, because like a few months ago, I had an interview with Diane Larson-Freeman, who is
a teacher.
She started as an English teacher, and then she's an applied linguist, right? Which means that the work that she does is actually practical rather than theoretical.
Yeah,
right? She's written various books about language acquisition. And the first question I asked her when I met with her is, so Diane, what's the secret to learning a language? And she said, I don't know. Right. And this is after 50 years.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, so, of course. There is no secret.
So like when I see a 23-year-old guy on YouTube going, hey guys, you know, $59.99 a month, I've got the secret, you'll be fluent in 6 months. I'm like, no, you won't.
Also, the stupid thing about that, saying the secret to blah, 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 is like, it's not a secret. There's a whole industry. There's a whole machine. Its entire purpose is to tell everyone everything that we know about how to learn a language. That for 20 years, I've been banging on about it in classrooms, you know, explaining it as explicitly and clearly as I possibly can, how to learn English. There's no secret. No one's keeping this stuff secret. Oh, we know how to learn a language, but let's not tell anyone. It's crazy. There's no secret. That's just sales language, isn't it? I mean, that's clickbait. I have a question for you about that, but
I wonder if you're going to ask me about how clickbaity some of my video titles are.
Yeah. Go ahead. That is one of my questions. So, yeah, I was going to say, where do you stand on clickbait? And it might be necessary to define clickbait for some viewers or listeners who don't really know what we mean. So what is clickbait?
I would say that clickbait is either an image, you know, so like a video thumbnail image or a title or a description that's designed to attract you to click on the video or to like listen to the podcast. But the problem with clickbait is that usually this surface appearance, you know, so the first thing you see doesn't actually represent what's inside the video, right?
Yes.
So you'll see this on a lot of videos on YouTube in general, where it will be a video about fishing. And of course, the thumbnail is, you know, a girl in a bikini with a fish. You know, so you click on it because you want to see the girl in the bikini, not because you're interested in fishing.
Yeah. Right?
And then when you watch the video, the girl in the bikini is not even in the video, right? That's clickbait.
Yeah. Yeah. Other examples. I mean, I watch a lot of videos because I'm a bit of a geek about films and things, right? And there are tons of videos about Star Wars and Marvel movies where they're like, you know, like Thanos's secret plan. And then there's like a picture of Thanos from Avengers Endgame with a red circle around like something on his shoulder. And there's like a red circle on his shoulder. And you're like, wow, what is this theory? What was Thanos' secret plan? But of course, you know, it's just clickbait. There's no actual content. It's just a guy saying, you know, hi guys, today we're going to do three PlayStation giveaways. It's just PlayStation giveaways and really nothing else. So yeah, that's clickbait. But clickbait is
why are they
also
always American?
I don't know. But clickbait is kind of rife in the English teaching online as well. So where do you stand on clickbait? Because I think some of your videos have quite clickbaity titles. Let's just see if I can think of an example. Hold on a second. Well, you can probably think off the top.
Uploaded a video recently. I think I called it like three secrets to getting fluent, right? I mean, that is super clickbaity, right?
Yeah, let me see.
What are these three secrets that I have been hiding from everybody, right, Luke?
Yeah, you've got one of yours says, stop speaking English wrong. Yeah. Another one says, three steps for perfect English.
Three steps of perfect
and
English.
Okay. What else have you got? One trick to learn everyday English and so on.
Yeah.
So quite clickbaity titles.
Yeah, no, they are. You know, I'm playing the game on YouTube. You know, I think there's two ways to approach content creation that I have discovered, right? Which is the first way is that you follow the algorithm, right? Which is a great way to increase your chances of success. You know, so like what's trending, you know, within my field, like within English teaching, what are the videos that have like 5 million views each? What are the titles of those videos? Right. And you can go down that path and you can follow the algorithm and you can make content that's more likely to become really successful, you know, or you can go the other way and you can just basically make content that you think is really good and really passionate and you're really passionate about, that you want to make content about, and then kind of hope that it gets traction, right? But you obviously have a much lower chance, much lower probability of success doing that.
Yes.
You know, so I'm doing both. So basically I make videos about whatever I want to make a video about that I'm really interested in. And then I try to find a way to, when I upload it, I try to find a way to make it attractive to click on.
Yes.
You know, I obviously try not to misrepresent the content. Like if I say there's three steps, then in the video, you're going to find three steps. You know, and if I say there's one trick, then in the video you're going to find one trick. But are they misleading? Are they maybe in a way?
I don't think so, because actually a lot of the time what you do is you have a clickbaity title, but then the content of the video is sort of the antidote to that kind of thing, in the sense that you. You know, it's like one secret for learning English, and the secret is there is no secret, or you know, that sort of thing. That you tend to the content is authentic and sincere, despite the clickbaity title. Whereas the worst clickbait is where there's something promised in the title, and absolutely nothing is really delivered at all, because they've achieved what they needed to achieve, which is that you watch the advert at the beginning of the video. Yes. And it's like, right, well, there you go. Now I'm going to just spin this out for the next 10 minutes. But yours, at least there is some sort of message, which is like, there is no secret to learning this. Or, you know, that grammar is not just about right and wrong, that there's a lot of gray area and this isn't always reflected in exams. And, you know, there is some content that backs it up, I think, often.
Yeah, I mean, but I think you could argue that sometimes it is misleading. And I would have to agree with that, but you know, this is just a result of, you know, I'm not going to lie, you know, I want people to watch my content. It's not really about the money, because, you know, unless you have, you know, millions of views like a month, which I don't have, unless you have that, you know, you're not, it's not a full-time job. You know, you can't live off ad revenue from YouTube. So, you know, it's not about the money. It's just about, I don't know. I suppose I think my message is important. I want people to hear it. You know, that's just narcissism, maybe. Look at me. Look at me.
Look at my lovely thick beard.
I mean, you want people to listen to your podcast, right?
Yeah, and I'm sure
it's not about money for you either, I imagine.
Well, I mean, a little bit, you know, obviously I need to be able to pay for the time that I spend on doing this. So yeah, it's got to be worthwhile. If I didn't make a living from this, I wouldn't be doing it. So yeah, I mean, to an extent it's about the money, but yeah, of course I want people to listen to me. I want my voice to be heard. I mean, you know, as a content creator, of course, you want your content to be consumed. As a comedian, you want to have an audience. As an English teacher, you want students in your class. If you're a radio presenter, you want people to be actually listening to the show. So, yeah, I guess the clickbait is just part of the game, that you've got to get people to click on your content. And then, you know, what you deliver after that is another question. We were talking before about how I think sometimes you present slightly controversial points of view, or maybe sort of polemical points where you disagree with something, or you sort of like smash myths and things. Are you trying to court some controversy or something? And what's the motivation behind that? Are you trying to kind of blow people's minds, or what? Do you want people to disagree with you? Are you like, are you up for a scrap? What's going on?
Yeah, I do. I definitely get accused of that. It's like, you're only doing this for attention. Like, for example, with the crash and video, there was a lot of accusations that I did it just, you know, just to get attention, just for clicks, you know, which is absolutely, you know, which I can say genuinely it's not true, but you know, obviously that's up to people whether they believe me or not. Right. I mean, I'm absolutely not afraid of controversy, in places where I think it deserves. It's necessary, you know. I mean, there are a lot of things that I see every day on, you know, on like from YouTube channels or people selling courses, you know, promising things, and I just think it's wrong, and I think they should stop doing it, and so I'm going to make a lot of noise about that. But only where it's necessary. Like, you know, there are some things that I would not want to make any more controversy. Some areas, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, there was a, you know, to be completely transparent, you know, there was a moment there where it, I suppose I was, you know, looking at other YouTube teachers, and I was like, well, that's not right, so I'm going to call them out, you know. But I think I've decided that I'm not going to do that anymore, because it's too complicated from a social standpoint, you know.
It's very fraught, because you end up dealing with the personalities of the people you're criticizing, and what happens on social media, which is when one figure criticizes another figure, then all the sort of a lot of followers will sort of pile in on that person, and you get that kind of situation, which is not necessarily what you wanted to do, I'm sure, but that kind of thing can happen, and that's very awful.
Yeah. But you know what it's great for? All of that, you know, like bitching about other people and you know, like attacking other people, it's great for views and clicks, right? It's great. Like if I wanted to go down that road, you know, they say that there's no such thing as bad publicity, right? So even if you have a million views and everybody hates you, still a million views, right? So that's a road you can go down.
Imagine if you became the Donald Trump of English teaching.
Oh, wow.
I got to tell you, folks, Luke Thompson is a horrible English teacher. And believe me, folks, I know English teaching. If you suddenly started doing that, that would be pretty shocking.
You're so good at that.
It was Barack Obama last time. Now it's Trump. So there's lots of things I could ask you about. Like a couple of years ago, you were sort of like on a mission about course books and workbooks. Yeah. So if I say the words, if I say, you know, English language workbook to you, mm-hmm. what's your response?
I got any here. Where's the shredder?
I'm currently holding up a copy of English File Upper Intermediate. Ooh. Do you like Ooh. English File Upper Intermediate, Christian?
The urge in me is very strong to rip that out of your hands and throw it out of the window.
Really? Really? Why? What's wrong with English File? Everyone likes English File, don't they?
I don't. I think the reason that I don't like workbooks is because I think that any English class would be immediately better if you just got rid of them.
Yeah, but you say that when I first started teaching, or like a couple of years in or whatever, the idea of going into the class with nothing was absolutely terrifying. And books like English File and others were a lifeline for an inexperienced teacher, and I learned so many things from those books. But you have a case against sort of some of the principles which underpin course books being used in the class.
Yeah, I mean, I have something, you know, I have my opinion about that, and you know, and look, this is nothing personal, right? But, you know, when I, as you said before, being born as a native speaker, we automatically have this, we're born with this privilege of, you know, knowing without any effort, this global language. And, you know, when I first started teaching, I had no right to be teaching because I didn't know a damn thing about teaching. And I didn't know a damn thing about the English language except that I spoke it.
You weren't qualified at that point.
No.
I assume no.
I'm still not qualified. I have never done a TEFL course. I've never done a CELTA, DELTA. I haven't been to university. Nothing, right?
Okay. So what, you have no qualifications at all?
No. I dropped out of high school, and you know, I went and worked in a video shop in Blockbuster. Should I have been teaching students? No, I shouldn't have been. But I was able to do it because two reasons. One, because I had this ability that I didn't acquire through effort. I didn't, you know, like knowing a language as a native speaker is not the same as knowing it, you know, so that you can teach it, right? You know, I'd never heard of past perfect in my life, right? In my life.
Yeah.
Of course, like most monolingual native speakers of English, they don't have no idea about grammar, right?
When I was doing my CELTA, which you haven't done, Christian, very disappointing. But when I was doing my CELTA, I remember having to teach present perfect and stuff. And I remember having a conversation in the kitchen with my mum and dad about what the hell present perfect was. And we're all disagreeing. And, you know, it was terrible. I didn't know what a lot of the grammar was. And it's taken me quite a lot of effort and work and studying and, you know, lots of time spent trying to decode present perfect and what it is and what the problem is with it and all that sort of stuff. Yes, it takes a long time.
It does. Yeah. But the other reason that I was able to immediately start work is because the students, they had this idea, this preconceived idea that because I was a native speaker, I could teach them English, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it was just the combination of both of these things. It's like the arrogance of being a native speaker plus the willingness of the students, that combination, it works. And how many millions of English teachers are out there backpacking in China or Vietnam right now doing classes and they have no idea about language, right?
Yes, probably a lot. Oh, yes, very many.
But I would say I would say that that they shouldn't be there, right? And if you're not able to do classes without workbooks, then you're not ready, you know? Like, and I don't know if now, looking back, if you agree with that, like, would you feel comfortable now with all your experience doing classes without pulling out English file?
I would, yes. Yeah. I'm just wondering when that happened. I mean, you know, the beginning of my career, I was teaching in Japan, and I've talked about it before on my podcast that the conditions were pretty difficult. So I would have a 9-hour day, something like 8 lessons during the day. At the beginning of the day, I didn't know who my students were, and I'd have 3 or 4 students in each class. So you get, it's pinned on the notice board at the beginning of the day what the classes are, and students are added as you go through the day. And it goes like this. You first lesson, you know, you've got like a few minutes beforehand to prepare. You look at the students and what they've done and the lessons they haven't done. You find the ones that they all haven't done, and then you teach them that lesson. You've got a few minutes to prepare the lesson, and then you go in for 45 minutes and teach it. Then the bell goes, and you've got 10 minutes from that moment until the bell goes for the next class to get out of the class, write all your notes for each student, put the files back, find the new files for your next class, work out what they need to do, prepare and plan your entire lesson, get in the class and start teaching it all in 10 minutes. So I had to learn to kind of make it up as I went along quite a lot. It was tough. So I have had some experience of doing that. But, you know, teaching sort of multinational groups of people from different countries in London, where they've paid to travel to be there, and the pressure is really on, that going in with nothing is just crazy. And also having done the Delta, which, you know, I'm very disappointed to know that you haven't done, but doing the Delta, they were always said, you know, that with the Delta, you have to spend weeks preparing for one lesson where you've got a language point that you're going to teach in that lesson, and you have to write a full essay explaining the ins and outs of that, and then a fully broken down lesson plan where every single moment is accounted for. And then if you, so you've got to prepare a lot. And then, of course, what happens is in the classroom, you have to be prepared to throw the lesson plan out of the window and teach the students. But anyway, my point is the idea of now, I think I could go into class without any material and just kind of do it. And I do that a lot, but that I probably only got the confidence to do that, I don't know, even 10 years ago, maybe.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think maybe something that I should make clear is I think the choice is not between, should we have workbooks or should we have nothing, right? That's not the choice. Yes. The choice is, should we do workbooks in which the content of what I'm teaching has been decided by other people, right? Who don't know me, who don't know my students, who don't know how much time I have, who don't know how many kids I have in my class, who don't know how old they are, what they're interested in, what the culture is, nothing. All they know is that they're in an office in London, and here's a little box with 10 words about Shakira, because let's do some pop music, because pop music's cool, and the kids love pop music, and they love Shakira. Right? That kind of thing. There's okay. That choice. Or the choice is, as a teacher, and I would hope as a teacher who's not teaching 8 hours a day, because that's just untenable.
It was horrible, so, yeah.
You know, as a teacher, that you would take the time to ask your students, you know, not just take the time, but have the time, right? To ask your students, guys, what do you need, right? What are you interested in? How can I help you to achieve whatever your goal is, right? And let's make a plan based on that. You know, that to me is just a kind of fundamental thing, right?
Absolutely. And then, you know, to work out what their priorities are and their needs. But then what I would probably do after having that discussion is go off and find a combination of material and stuff that I've come up with myself, which then I think fits that thing. But what you've often said about workbooks is, as one of the things I think you disagree with about them, is the idea that there is a basic black and white right and wrong in language learning, and that especially when learning grammar, you have these let's say, even in tests or exercises, you have gap fills where there's supposed to be one answer. And you gave an example in your in one of your videos, and the example was this: after the match, she admitted that she blank badly. And the options are: after the match, she admitted that she played badly, that she had played badly, or that she had been playing badly. And your point is that they're all possible. All three responses are possible.
I mean, I'm sure that you can imagine, you know, you can instantly imagine three scenarios in which those sentences are possible, right?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
How can you tell a student they're wrong?
So the thing is with that question, after the match, she admitted that she played badly. She admitted that she had played badly. She admitted that she had been playing badly. So when you discovered this, was there one answer that was given as the only correct answer in that?
Yes, there was. There was the first option. I think she had. She played.
She played badly.
Yeah. There was one. And the others were marked as the other. The second answer, I think, was marked in brackets as also possible, right?
Okay.
And then the third one was marked as incorrect. And so, you know, students develop this idea over time that there's got to be one way for me to do this. But the thing is that, you know, if I'm making a decision between which verb is correct, I need to know the whole story. You know, I need to know, you know, how does this fit in with other sentences or in the context? I mean, so I think it's very dangerous to teach students to just learn stuff in isolation.
You know? I think I have to say that does that not support Stephen Krashen's model, which is that for him, context is everything, and that understanding the 80% allows you to fill the blanks. And with the grammatical and meaning context, that's what helps you understand the grammar. You know, is that not his point?
I don't think that that's part of his theory, really. Not specifically that, right?
But he does argue that you can kind of learn grammar through consuming language sort of...
You can, right? I think we all know people that have moved to a new country and they've, you know, got a job or whatever, and within a year they're really, you know, really able to communicate really well, you know. But they haven't done any study, you know. They've picked it up through just trial and error, through probably uncomfortable and difficult work, you know, of being situations where you don't understand and you don't have the words, and you know, number one, I would say that if we're specifically talking about the input hypothesis, none of those people have only listened. They've also struggled over that time to participate, you know?
Definitely.
And the second thing is that, that takes a very specific type of personality. You know, you have to be really brave, and you have to not be afraid at all of kind of making a fool of yourself. And also, it's also uncomfortable for other people, right? When they're kind of waiting for you to produce this sentence, and you know, they have to wait 10 minutes because your Spanish or your French is so bad that you're sort of like, you know, Joe, you know, hablar, and they're like, oh my God, just, you know, you know, so to be in a situation where you know that you're making others uncomfortable, that also, you know, takes a specific type of personality, right? But the third thing, and I think this is the most important, is that it's not as fast or efficient to do it that way. You know, if a student spent half of their time doing that horrible, difficult stuff, and the other half of their time hitting a bit of deliberate study, a bit of grammar, you know, a bit of, when I say deliberate study, I would say like focused attention. So not just reading a book, but reading a paragraph and pulling it apart and taking the time to say, why is it like this? You know, doing that person would learn much faster. I think that's the key thing.
You know? Yes. Yeah. I agree with the idea of combining different approaches and trying to, you know, the balanced diet, trying to combine and do lots of things. We could talk more about lots of other things, but I would say maybe we can wrap up by just sort of saying, what are your top tips for learning English, Christian? What is the secret to learning this language? Do you have any specific things that you could, recommend or suggest? That what do you think learners should be doing? Regardless of what they shouldn't be doing, what should they be doing?
Yeah. Okay. So I think that learners, and I hate to repeat myself, but I'm gonna do it again. Right. I think that learners should always start with the question, "What do I want?" You know, and it's fine if you want to say, you know what, I actually have I have no respect for this language. You know. I'm learning English because I've been forced to do it, you know, because I want to go to university, you know, I want to go to university. So, you know, I just need to pass this exam or whatever I need to do. That's fine. Like, be honest about your objective and do what you focus on what you need to do to get that done. If you just want to read, that's cool. You know, then you know that you can focus your attention on reading. But if you want to be, let's say, a balanced learner, right? So you want to be able to have conversations and read and talk about a variety of subjects. Then you have to practice those things, you know? So it always comes back to the question of what do you want? And you know, the same way as that people who are trying to lose weight, it's going to be very attractive when you see a product advertising something like the magic pill or, you know, this system or whatever it is that, you know, that seems too good to be true, you know? Mm-hmm. And if it seems too good to be true, then it is, you know, not it probably is, it is.
Yeah.
So just, you have to just accept the fact that learning a language is probably the hardest thing that you'll try to do as an adult. I think it's even more difficult than learning an instrument, which is already very hard, right? Mm-hmm. And it's not something that you just finish and it's done. It's something that you have to work on forever, like maintaining your weight or maintaining your guitar skills, you know? And so Definitely. The combination of knowing what you want and being realistic, I think, is the secret to success.
Okay. All right. Very good. Very good. Thank you for talking to me and my audience about all these things. There's lots of other things I could have asked you, but we don't have time, I think.
Part three.
Yes, it'll have to be a part three. What are you working on at the moment? This is my final question. Are you working on something specific? Three things?
I'm working on three exciting projects, which have been unfortunately delayed because of, you know, COVID and, you know, things. So the first thing is I'm working on a project called Blank Workbooks, which are hopefully going to solve the problem that you talked about before. So a teacher who wants to take control of what's happening in class, but is not experienced or confident enough to not live without a workbook, this will be the solution, the blank workbook. The second thing I'm working on is an app, which is hopefully going to fulfill my ambition of creating a place where people can practice. So it's not about learning, it's about practicing. Because there's lots of apps for learning, like Duolingo and, you know, all that. And the third thing is a secret project that I can't tell you about.
Oh. Is it about the secret for learning English? okay, great. But before you go, let me ask you about Pencils of Promise and the project to build schools. In sort of places that need them, Laos, I understand. What's the situation with the project at the moment?
Yeah, so last time I talked to you, we were kind of in the middle of raising this money to build a school. And I'm happy to say that in, I think it was in May, we reached our fundraising target. So we raised $50,000 to build a school. And it's going to be in a very small community in the north of the country of Laos. And there's like 136 students who go to the school. At the moment, some of the students, there's not enough space for them in the school they have now. So they have to walk three or four kilometers each way every day to go to school. Wow. And when the school's built, they won't have to do that. But I think the thing I want to say about it is that it was a kangaroo community project, and it was hundreds of ordinary people who don't actually have a lot of money, who were extremely generous, and we all worked together to raise this money. And we're pretty excited about the fact that sometime early next year there's going to be this school. So,
yeah, it's amazing.
Yeah, it is amazing.
And the project continues, am I right? You're also going to continue raising money to pay for other schools as well, I think.
Yeah, yeah. I want to make I'm kind of working with Pencils of Promise. For example, today I'm giving a presentation about Global English to their team, which is actually training for native speakers, teaching native speakers how to interact in this world where we are completely outnumbered by non-native speakers. Right.
Yeah,
we have a lot of work to do because we are bad communicators in English.
Absolutely. Yeah, this is really, really interesting. And I've always thought that native speakers who are communicating with non-native speakers need training so that they're not using idioms all the time. They're sort of they're understanding what non-native speakers have to deal with when understanding them. Yeah, really interesting. Oh, that's good.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
So that's exactly what we're doing. And we're talking about idioms, and we're talking about all of the types of language that make international communication really difficult, right? And, you know, we take too much advantage of our privilege as native speakers, but we're the ones losing out, right?
Yeah.
Not the non-native speakers, it's us. So we have work to do, right?
The attitude's a bit sickening, isn't it? Where it's basically like a native speaker says, well, you're the one learning my language. You have to make 100% of the effort, and I will just carry on speaking in exactly the same way without bending to help you at all. Everything can be so much easier if the native speakers just sort of made a bit more effort to change their position a bit.
Exactly. Exactly. So that's a really interesting area, I think, of, you know, in the future I'm going to be talking a bit more about that. In the future, I would like to make Pencils of Promise, you know, I would like to make building schools part of what I do, you know, because it's just very satisfying, actually.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you still need contributions or volunteers or help at all?
At the moment, fundraising is paused for summer, right? Everyone's taking a break for summer. But in September, we're going to be starting again to build school number two. I'm going to be making announcements on my social media and through my newsletter. If anyone is interested in helping to build schools, I'll be making announcements about that. Yeah.
Your newsletter is on your website, I guess.
Yeah. So if you go to kangarooenglish.com, you can subscribe to my newsletter or I'm going to be making announcements there about stuff. So, yeah.
Okay. Very good.
Thanks for the opportunity to talk about that. I appreciate it.
Yeah, it's a pleasure, of course. Okay, good luck with the workshop today, and we look forward to finding out about these projects, including the secret one. Sounds interesting. Okay, Christian, have a good day. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Luke. Awesome.
English.
English, dude. English.
English.
English fish.
English.
Plain English, creep.
Speak English.
Oh, you speak English now?
Yes, I learned.
So that was Christian from Kangaroo English. Thanks again to Christian. And here we are at the end of yet another episode. I wonder what you thought of the points which came up in that conversation. Feel free to let us know in the comments section or perhaps under the YouTube version of this. Where do you stand on things like comprehensible input, workbooks and clickbait titles? Let us know. For me, this is one of the last episodes I'm recording before officially starting my summer holiday. As usual, I have loads of stuff to record and publish before I go away, and I might end up recording some of it while I am back in the UK. But here's a little overview of what's in the pipeline right now. So after this, I'm planning to do a summer ramble where I just ramble on about sort of recent bits of news and certain little announcements and things. So that should be coming soon. And then after that, I've got a series of episodes which I recorded a few months ago now and that have been waiting to be published. These are the ones that have been in the pipeline for so long. And so I've got three episodes in which I tell you a story, and I've been thinking, shall I reveal the story? And I think I will. So I'm going to be reading extracts from War of the Worlds by H.G. Wells. People have been asking me for more story content, and it's a little tricky to find the right kind of stories. But anyway, I chose this one. I've got lots of other stories planned as well, but I chose this one this time. It's one of my favourite stories, and so three episodes where I read extracts from that story and explain certain things. Also in the pipeline is the whole series of P31, that's premium series 31, called What Did Jill Say? That'll be six parts. Three parts focusing on language, breaking down language, helping you understand it, helping you to use it, grammar and vocabulary, and then three parts focusing just on the pronunciation. So giving you pronunciation drills where I repeat sentences that contain the target language, you have to repeat them. So that's P31. So those are things in the pipeline, but I've got lots of other episodes planned. But anyway, I have my work cut out. I'd like to kind of get all that content out over the next few weeks, but I am going on holiday. In terms of holiday, we're going back to the UK to stay at my parents' place, and we will have to deal with the whole quarantine thing. We're going to have to quarantine there, and you know, you have to take day 2 and day 8 tests and all that stuff. It's quite annoying. But after we quarantine, we will be going to a posh campsite for some glamping. So glamping, do you know what that is? It's like camping, but it's kind of glamorous camping. So you can call it glamping. So we're going to go and do some glamping and stay in a nice tent, which has got like plug sockets in it for charging your phone, and a fire pit outside and a barbecue and stuff. It should be nice. I hope the weather will be okay. So but generally spending a couple of weeks in the UK. Meanwhile, our new flat in Paris, so I'll be explaining more of this in the rambling episode, but our new flat in Paris is being demolished at the moment on the inside and then being remade to our specifications. So let's hope that all goes according to plan. Anyway, as I said, I'll talk more about all this stuff in that rambling episode, which is coming up next, I hope, although I haven't actually recorded it yet. I don't know when I'll be able to do it. But anyway, that's coming soon. But in any case, I will speak to you again soon in some form. But for now, it's just time for me to say to everyone in Lapland, have a lovely sleep, because obviously you're all going to bed now, aren't you? Because that, for some reason, I imagine at the end of every episode, everyone's sort of tucked up in bed and you're all going to go to sleep now. But that's the end of the episode. You're all tucked up in bed. You've brushed your teeth and everything. Very good. Okay, well, have a lovely sleep and I'll speak to you in the morning. Okay, all right, everyone. Good night. Okay, goodbye. Bye.
Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye.
Thanks for listening to Luke's English podcast. For more information, visit teacherluke.co.uk.
Hold up. when it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
If you enjoyed this episode of Luke's English Podcast, consider signing up for Luke's English Podcast Premium. You'll get regular premium episodes with stories, vocabulary, grammar, and pronunciation teaching from me, and the usual moments of humor and fun. Plus, with your subscription, you will be directly supporting my work and making this whole podcast project possible. For more information about Luke's English Podcast Premium, go to teacherluke.co.uk/premium info.